Welcome back to another month of the PigX podcast. I'm your host, Delaney Howell. On today's episode, we'll be discussing the recently built National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, hereon referred to as NBAF, which was designed to protect the nation's agriculture, farmers, and citizens from serious animal diseases. Located in Manhattan, Kansas, the scientists from the USDA's Agriculture Research Service at this facility will work to provide critical information to safeguard U.S. agriculture and address public health threats from foreign animal diseases, some of which can spread to humans. NBAF succeeds the Plum Island Animal Disease Center in New York, which has long been a cornerstone in protecting American agriculture. As NBAF becomes fully operational, it will take over Plum Island's mission. In this episode, you'll learn what unique features the new facility has, how it will have an impact on the swine industry, and what producers and agricultural stakeholders need to know. We'll hear from Dr. Chad Meir, the research leader for Foreign Arthropod-Borne Animal Disease Research Unit within ARS, and Dr. Robin Holland, the director of the Foreign Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory with the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service within USDA. Let's start first by hearing from Dr. Chad Meir about his background and connection with the new facility.
Fabidrew is exactly how we shortened the Foreign Arthropod-Borne Animal Diseases Research Unit. Within that unit, we work on viruses that have yet to come into the United States and set themselves up here. They're not endemic to our area, and they're arthropod borne. So we work with viruses that are spread by insects, mainly mosquitoes, and then we work with some others that are spread by sandflies, black flies, or biting midges. Within that, these viruses that we work with, they can affect our agricultural economy, but they also can affect humans. They're zoonotic. How I came to be the research leader of this unit, I worked on viruses since graduate school. I worked on an arbovirus in graduate school called the vesicular stomatitis virus. It's spread by those insects that I've described, the sand flies, black flies, biting midges. And within that, I just learned the molecular virology of it, kind of the nuts and bolts of how the virus puts itself together and then enters into cells, just the very basics of it. And then I took that knowledge, and when I moved on to work on my postdoc at Boston University and then University of Texas Medical Branch, I started working with zoonotic emerging infectious diseases, such as Ebola virus, Nipah virus, these high containment viruses that, are yet to be here in the U.S., but, it's best to be prepared for them. As we saw with the SARS-2 outbreak, viruses can emerge and spread rapidly without, any kind of warning. So, it's best to be prepared for those. So those are the viruses that I worked with on my postdoc. And then as I went through to become faculty at University of Texas Medical Branch, I was still working in zoonotics, but what I had always seen was that, in these zoonotic diseases, which means, they can jump from animals to humans and humans to animals, there's not a lot of space in the high containment labs that we had here in the U.S. where we could work on agricultural animals, our livestock, that are part of really ramping up transmission of some of these viruses that could then jump to humans. So I was always interested in whether or not we could do that work. And I knew that the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, NBAF, was being built, as I worked in the high containment field, very small world, these things are going on. So I always had an eye towards whether or not there'd be opportunities here. And so I got an opportunity to then come to the USDA and, apply the knowledge that I learned about the nuts and bolts of viruses, and then also the zoonotic emerging infectious diseases to help come in and work on USDA's mission.
Great. Thank you for that background, Chad. Robin, what about you? My background, so I'm overseeing the unit at NBEF called the Foreign Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory. And so our moniker that we'll go by is FADL. And within FADL, we have five scientific units that all work together to achieve that diagnostic mission that we have. And so how I got to NBAF is going back from the beginning. I grew up on a small family-owned and operated dairy farm in northwestern Illinois. So I'm more from the cattle side of things. And then as I went through kind of my career and getting more education in agriculture and then infectious diseases, so I am a veterinarian with a PhD in microbiology and pathobiology. So I always had that passion for infectious diseases, understanding host pathogen interactions and what that means for animal health. So how do you bridge that gap between the basic biology of these diseases and the impact that it has on various different species? And so I really love that merging of research and science with animal health. And so my background is more on diagnostics. So prior to coming to the USDA, I was involved in setting up a high throughput COVID diagnostic laboratory in Illinois. I did all my graduate school at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And then after working in that COVID lab, I then went out to the Plum Island Animal Disease Center, where I was overseeing our diagnostic mission for FADL. And working out at Plum Island is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have that ability to work at a facility that has the tremendous legacy that is our entire mission of what we are building at NBAF. And so Plum Island was established in 1954. The history and root of Plum Island is really focused on foot and mouth disease, and then it's been expanding over time to address new threats that are being identified in protecting U.S. agriculture. And so for FADL, we serve as a diagnostic laboratory. So where like Dr. Meir's group is more on the research side, for FADL, we're with diagnostics and regulatory work. And so we serve as a national and international reference laboratory for the highest consequence pathogens that are in livestock. So the big three that we are concerned about that we do diagnostics for are foot and mouth disease virus, African swine fever, and classical swine fever. And so if there's ever a situation in the US where there is an animal that is showing signs for one of these diseases, those samples right now are being sent to Plum Island. Later on, when our mission transfers to NBAF, those samples will go there. And we have that final determination of, is this real or not? Or, thankfully, all the testing that we're doing is negative. So we can give our stakeholders and producers that assurance to say, yes, this is not, the first detection of classical swine fever in the US since the 80s, or FMD since, the 1920s, or African swine fever ever. And so that relationship that we have with our stakeholders is so critical. And I was at Plum Island during a unique time because I was in the lab working on our diagnostics when, or in July of 2021, when we in FADL received samples from the Dominican Republic, did that testing, and we realized, oh, wow, this is actually real for African swine fever. And that was the first time that African swine fever had been detected in the entire Western Hemisphere in nearly 40 years. And so that put the highest consequence pathogen that we have for the swine industry on our doorstep. And so it was a fascinating time to be involved in all of the response measures across FADL and the rest of the National Veterinary Services laboratories to respond to this outbreak in the Dominican Republic and Haiti to help provide that support in country to control that disease, something that we're continuing to this day. So it's just last year when I then made the move out to Kansas. So still overseeing our diagnostics for FADL and getting really involved in helping to stand up that program at NBAF. So thank you for including me in the conversation today.
Great. Thank you. Very extensive backgrounds and appreciate that insight from both of you. Before we really dig into what NBAF does, I'd like to start first with what is NBAF? What does it stand for? And how did it come to formation years ago?
In BAF, so we were talking about acronyms, right? We throw a lot around like government. It stands for the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, and it's owned and operated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, in Manhattan, Kansas. And this mission of NBAF is to protect the United States' transgenic challenge boundary, emerging and zoonotic animal diseases. So, you know, just to give a little definition of that, foreigner transboundary, those can enter the U.S. from any country, right? So we're, you know, crossing boundaries to get to here. Emerging, these are new or not well known. So some viruses can emerge, you know, over decades, but, you know, they're just not always there. So we describe them as emerging that way. And then zoonotic, you know, these normally exist in animals, but then can also jump into humans. All these diseases that we work on at NBAF, they can threaten our food supply, agricultural economy, and public health. So this mission is very important to U.S. agriculture economy. NBAF will focus on livestock research, diagnostics, vaccine and countermeasure development, and also training and response of our personnel to be ready for any of these transboundary diseases that could come into the U.S. NBAF is going to be a critical component of USDA's priority to develop vaccines and countermeasures for, you know, all of these, as well as the early detection of that threaten the livestock and other animals, animals and food for the nation's farms and fields. Through these initiatives, USDA will expand its support of global health and food security and really come into this One Health approach that's really needed, you know, to be between the animal livestock interface, then also for the human interface for some of these diseases that, you know, threaten the U.S.
And to follow up on that with the history for NBAF of the legacy that's continuing on, I mentioned earlier the Plum Island Animal Disease Center. So the Plum Island Animal Disease Center was established in 1954. It's on Plum Island, so which is an actual island off the coast of Long Island in Connecticut. And this facility has been dedicated to protecting U.S. agriculture ever since it started. And it's impressive that a facility like this, a high biocontainment facility, has maintained operations for 70 years. This is a major achievement that Plum Island has accomplished. And it's due to the dedication of the staff, both scientists as well as operational staff, to keep this facility maintained for that length of time. And there have been significant achievements that Plum Island has made over time, not only for diagnostics, as I mentioned, in responding to different outbreaks, but also developing countermeasures, new vaccines, new diagnostic assays, things that we can provide to stakeholders, and being on the cutting edge and front edge of all that science that is being done. And when the need was identified to have that new facility that Plum Island would continue onto, there was a lot of different discussions of identifying where that would go. And so the decision was made to have NBAF in Manhattan, Kansas. So that entire mission that everybody is well aware of for Plum Island's work with African swine fever, classical swine fever, foot and mouth disease for diagnostics and research, that entire mission will be transferring to NBAF over time. And the same type of structure for the programs and services that we offer. So as we noted, USDA is where we all work. And so Dr. Muir is through the Agricultural Research Service, or ARS, with the research mission. And then myself in USDA, we are with the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. So we are more that regulatory and service response arm of USDA. And as we build out over time, some of our staff will be moving from Plum Island to NBAF, and we will house all of that expertise in various animal diseases, veterinarians, scientists, technicians, administrative support staff, operational staff. So we'll have this diverse workforce of all the support to run the facility. And there's just different types of work and acknowledgements that our folks will have over time, because as I noted for FADL, we do serve as an international reference laboratory for high consequence animal diseases. And we're excited to see that progress over time, adding in new recognition at NBAP, because as Dr. Muir mentioned, there's an expanded mission at NBAF with zoonotic, biosafety level 4 pathogens, and so that will be added into our expanded mission. So Robin, you mentioned APHIS, the APHIS unit and the ARS unit. How many different units make up NBAF today, and how does that structure work across departments and functions?
Great question. So NBAF is entirely a USDA-run facility. This is different from Plum Island. So Plum Island is owned and operated by the Department of Homeland Security. And then within that, we have ARS and APHIS as the USDA scientific presence. At NBAF, it's different in that it's entirely USDA-run. So the two major units within NBAF are indeed APHIS and ARS. Now, within that, not only do we have our scientific mission, but we also have our operational mission. I think the total number of individual units within NBAF is about 18 different ones. And so that includes groups like, you know, for myself with FADL and our five scientific units within APHIS, as well as Dr. Meir with Fabidru. But then we also have units like Safety, Health, and Environmental Management, our Biorisk Management units, our security team, communications team. So we have all of those different internal units, and it's purposely intermixed between APHIS and ARS for the operational units that build onto the scientific units as well.
So as you think about the MBAF facilities, you mentioned the transition happening from Plum Island to Manhattan, Kansas. Give me a little bit more background on what are the MBAF facilities and some of the biosafety labs that make up the structures.
So I can start off with this and I'll pass off to Dr. Meir because he has more experience on the BSL-4 side of things. So for Plum Island, the highest biosafety level that we have here is a BSL-3. So there are a total of four biosafety levels. So a biosafety level one facility is effectively like a high school biology lab. A BSL-2 facility is more of a university type of laboratory. That is where they're working on pathogens that have slightly higher risk, but there are readily available treatments and countermeasures that are there. For biosafety level 3, that is where you're increasing more risk. And so at Plum Island, we do not have a BSL-4. It is a BSL-3. And so the pathogens that we work with, African swine fever, classical swine fever, foot and mouth disease. But the unique part with NBAF is the BSL-4. And there I'll pass it off to Dr. Meir for his input.
Yeah, and so part of this, as Robin was describing for Plum Island, where they're working on foot and mouth disease, African swine fever, and classical swine fever, those are mainly agricultural pathogens. So, you know, if you're not going to, a human won't be able to be infected with those. So they're not a zoonotic pathogen. But with the expansion of the mission for USDA and this transition to NBAC, we've added zoonotic pathogens to that on the BSL-3 side and also on the BSL-4 side. So that means that we have to have a little bit more stringent measures to mitigate the risk, not only to keeping the pathogens within inside the lab, but also making sure that we have the facilities in place and the engineering there to make sure that we are keeping the health of everyone working there, a priority as well. And so not that that wasn't there for at Plum Island, but it's, specifically built here for high containment BSL-3 and BSL-4. And so for the BSL-3 zoonotic, if you're thinking about that, I mean, these are going to be labs that, you know, have places where you're going to go in and, put on your personal protective equipment, PPE. And so, you know, there was a day and time where, you know, we really had to describe what PPE is. But I think over, you know, after the SARS-2 outbreak, lots of folks understand what PPE is, what a positive air, you know, protective respirator is, a PAPR, so these are things when you're going into zoonotic BSL-3s, you have to have respiratory protection and also another layer of clothes that you're wearing over your scrubs that you're going in. And so you put those on before you go into the lab, and then you will take those off as you're leaving the lab. And so from that, from a BSL-3 perspective, from the BSL-4 perspective, this is, the entry and exit procedures are a little bit more stringent as far as, you know, there you're putting on a protective suit that you then have a HEPA filter on your suit. You're plugging into an air supply. And then, you know, we refer to them as, you know, as space suits in jargon for it. But within that, you go into the lab and you're working within this suit, plugged into air as you move about the lab. And then as you exit out, you are in a decon shower that then, you know, sprays down the whole exterior of your suit to decon you down. And then, you know, you disconnect from your air hose within the shower, and then you come out and you take off the suit, and, you know, you go about leaving the facility with the scrubs. And so, you know, just in thinking about that, the PPE is a measure to be able to protect the folks, but we also are donning and deconning as we're moving out to prevent anything, you know, any risk of pathogens coming out of the lab with where we're working. And so there's a little bit more of a process when it comes to working with the zoonotics that, you know, require a little bit more of engineering and facilities to be able to protect workers. And then, but, you know, there still are similar processes that are put out for what had been being done at Plum Island for some time as well. But we just have a few extra measures that we have to do from the zoonotic side.
And I just want to clarify one point. The Plum Island facilities will eventually close down completely to just be supported through the Manhattan, Kansas location. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is correct. It will be entirely decommissioned with all the science activities. All of that work will be transferred over to NBAF.
What do you think makes then the NBAF facility so unique or special, even in comparison to the Plum Island facility? Is it the biosecurity or biosafety levels that are allowed?
Yes, that's definitely one part of it that makes it unique. There are other BSL-4 facilities in the United States, but there are no BSL-4 facilities with the capacity to hold large livestock in the United States. And that's one of those big things that really makes it unique. There's only 5 of those facilities globally. So it's an unusual type of place to be able to have that high level biosecurity and safety and security of the work that's being done, but also being able to understand these diseases in the species that we are predominantly concerned about, being large livestock. It's also unique in that we have that interrelatedness between APHIS and ARS. We have very different missions. So APHIS being regulatory, ARS being on research, and we can work together to keep that science moving forward, but while also addressing the needs of our direct stakeholders and getting that science advancement into the hands of the people who are actively supporting animal health in the field. So that relationship is key. And the expanded mission that we have with other types of diseases that we will be adding in. So it's fantastic that we have the scope of work that we have at Plum, but there are other diseases that are coming forward on concern globally. I know the swine industry was very concerned about Japanese encephalitis due to the outbreak that was happening in Australia. And so that's part of our scope of mission work that we'll be adding in so we can make sure that we are meeting the needs of our stakeholders to protect animal health.
So then as you think about maybe the impact this has at a producer level or folks working in the swine system day to day, what kind of impact will this have on the swine industry?
Yeah, so Delaney, the impact that it'll have on the swine industry, I think, you know, while I didn't work at Plum Island like Dr. Holland has, I have gone there and I've been in the spaces and seen the great work that's being done there. You know, one of the things is that the transition from Plum to NBAF immediately increases the amount of lab space for work to be done on these agricultural pathogens that we'll be working on. And so, you know, you can then imagine that we're going to be able to do more and, you know, be able to meet milestones and timelines and work on vaccines and countermeasures at a quicker pace, just from being able to have more lab space to be able to do it. You know, one of the major things of high containment labs is having space, and, you know, there's generally no shortage of problems and questions that folks want to be able to go into the lab and answer, but, you know, there's only so much space for that. So one of the things that, you know, really struck me and was enticing to me to come and work at NBAF is the, you know, the size and the scope that can be done here. On top of that, we're also expanding into the zoonotic space, within emerging disease space. So, you know, while there's been lots of great work done on African swine fever and classical swine fever for the swine industry, You know, as Dr. Pollan was just mentioning, you know, there's the Japanese encephalitis virus outbreak that really, you know, kind of shook the swine producers of Australia. And, you know, also was a bit of a wake-up call for the U.S. on the side of, you know, there were certain things that happened in that outbreak that, you know, we didn't consider risks. And in fact, we just published a paper with our collaborators at like Kent State University, looking at reevaluating the risk to the U.S. for Japanese encephalitis virus becoming endemic here. And a part of that would be the swine industry as one of the major transmission points for Japanese encephalitis virus is mosquitoes passing this virus onto pigs, and then pigs can replicate this virus to very high levels that helped this virus really take hold where it's at. So we're also not only adding space to be able to do more work on what's been done at Club Island, but we're also adding things for Japanese encephalitis virus as one example. And then from the BSL-4 zoonotic side, there's a virus called Nipah virus that, you know, spreads from bats to pigs, you know, so like pigs are important, part of some of the cycles of these viruses. And so NBAT's going to allow us to not only, you know, like I was saying, expand for doing more work on classical swine fever and African swine fever, but also allowing us to work on viruses that the U.S. did not have an opportunity to work on before because we didn't have facilities like NBAPS to do that. Additionally, we have something that no other high containment facility has in the U.S. is something called the Biologics Development Module. And this is a space where we can enhance and expedite the transition of new countermeasures to go from research to commercially viable countermeasures. Apparently, the way that research goes is you have to do experiments with what, like, say you have a vaccine that you're developing. Well, you're going to grow the vaccine in your lab, provide a little bit. And so it's going to be at small volumes, really. And you're going to take it, you're going to test it in animals. It's going to work. Well, that's great. But, you know, you just dosed maybe only 10 animals in that experiment. But now we're talking about something where we need, you know, 100 million doses or more for this vaccine. And so what you've used to make up for that small animal experiment, does that really relate to, you know, having to do this huge process in manufacturing that, you know, does it scale? Can it scale? And there's lots of vaccines that work in research at low levels like that, but never really make it through the manufacturing process to scale because of just the way that things need to be provided to make the products viable, safe, and have long shelf life. These are all things we don't think about as researchers while we're just trying to get something to work. But this Biologics Development Module, BDM, allows us to have the capacity to take something that we do in the lab here at NBAF, take it to the BDM, they work on it to bring it up to scale, and then we can take it back into the lab and test whether or not, as we scale up, do we have something that's viable as a countermeasure for manufacturing.
And to add to that with the relationship with our stakeholders, this is why we're here. Our job is to protect U.S. agriculture by conducting this innovative science and providing those diagnostic services. And for our diagnostic support that we have every single day within FADL, currently at Plum Island, later on at NBAF, we're receiving samples directly from the field, and these are from cases where there are concerns for one of these high consequence diseases. So that may be, say, a pig with a blister on its snout, or maybe there are hemorrhagic lesions, or maybe there was a large mortality, sudden die-off. Those are all things that we receive samples, and all of our scientific staff, our veterinarians, our microbiologists, our technicians, understand that direct impact to the field and our stakeholders. And we understand the impact of these diseases and what it means if there were to be the first detection of ASF in the United States ever what that means. And so our staff receive the samples, they do the testing as efficiently as possible so we can get those results out with very high quality to our stakeholders. So then the folks in the field can then take the responses that they need. If we were to have a detection, we would initiate the outbreak responses, or we can give everyone that sigh of relief to say, yes, thank you for doing the due diligence and doing the testing so we can say with a surety that ASF is not here. We have what's called a foreign animal disease diagnostician training course that is currently underway. And through this course, we have veterinarians and they are receiving firsthand training in how to diagnose these diseases. They are learning what clinical signs these look like, what samples to collect, how to send samples to the field. I'm excited for that training program to transition to NBAF over time. I know the science. I know our diagnostics. I know the lab. But as I noted, I don't have that background as being a swine producer. And so when we can have those opportunities to talk to those stakeholders and understand what challenges our stakeholders are encountering, what are their primary concerns, we can better devise recommendations and policies and sampling strategies, surveillance strategies, so we can best meet the stakeholders of our group. And so we are very fortunate that we have that relationship with our stakeholders.
One final question. What do you think swine producers need to know about the new and improved facility?
So according to the World Organization for Animal Health and the World Health Organization, more than 70% of new emerging infectious diseases in humans are indeed zoonotic, meaning that they have that connection between animals and humans. And I think Dr. Meir did a really nice job of explaining the impact that before and the different types of diseases that we have concerns with. So as we all know, our nation's agricultural producers work in proximity with livestock and are susceptible to these diseases. And so when we have that zoonotic component as part of our mission, not only are we directly benefiting the agricultural side of our mission, but also the people part of it. So all of the individuals who are working in those industries to make sure that we're protecting their health by understanding that transfer on the zoonotic side as well. So for our food and agricultural economy, so the current estimate is that accounts for more than $1 trillion U.S. dollars of the U.S. gross domestic product. That is significant. If there were to be an introduction of any of these transboundary animal diseases into the United States, of what that means for our industry. So being on the front edge of the science, having accurate and timely diagnostics so we would know if there were to be an introduction is critical so we can maintain that capacity for preparedness as well as outbreak responses.
Yeah, and as Dr. Holland was saying, you know, we're working on things that, you know, where agricultural producers are in proximity to the livestock, where these viruses, you know, at least on the end of this expanded mission of NBAF, can be zoonotic. And, you know, we're working in these high containment labs to be able to do that. And, you know, these all have three components to virus management, because we are working with viruses that are of concern, but we're concerned as about these viruses and need to know about them and really do our research on them. As Dr. Holland described, you know, over $1 trillion of the U.S. gross domestic product is part of this agricultural space. So within this, we have three components to for the risk management. And the number one is the biocontainment. This has redundancy of engineering controls and facility design. You know, at NBAF, this includes facility systems like our fluid decontamination tanks. These are these big tanks that take any kind of waste that goes through the drains, anything that's done inside the lab, these go into these tanks, these big, huge cooker tanks. So that's what they mean by the effluent there. We can have contamination tanks. We have thermo tissue autoclaves to take care of the tissue that's there for many animal experiments that we do. We have air pressure resistant doors, high efficiency particle accelerator filters, and tornado readiness here, as we're, you know, we're in country that gets you know, big thunderstorms and can have high winds. So we're set up for those things, you know, and there are other mitigations that happen for other high containment labs that are elsewhere as well. You know, like I was mentioning before, I was at University of Texas Medical Branch. That's down there on the Gulf Coast on Galveston Island. And, you know, there are mitigations and risks that are set up for that building that was built to be able to withstand hurricanes as well. So this isn't something that's, you know, odd for places to be built to be able to be ready for anything that's, you know, within the region. Biosafety is one of the other three components. This includes personal protective equipment that PPE we discussed earlier. Having processes and training for how to wear this PPE, how to put it on, how to take it off appropriately while entering and exiting the lab, and how to work with the pathogens safely within lab spaces. The last of the three components for biorisk management is biosecurity. This includes things like physical facility security. All staff and personnel that work and go into the labs have background checks and clearances that are required. We have security personnel and their own set of procedures and processes that you know, they go through. But we also have those procedures and processes within a lab for the biosecurity there. Additionally, MBAF is one on the leading edge in developing a culture of high reliability organization. And then these HROs have a strong safety culture and emphasis on planning to prevent system failures, despite working on in a high risk environment. And then some of these examples of HROs would include aircraft carriers, nuclear power plants, and some hospitals. You know, the idea is it's an ideal culture to work in because, you know, we're encouraged at MBAF to be able to take a leadership role in looking for areas where there could be failure and to discuss those concerns and work together to mitigate them. You know, anyone in the facility, if they see anything from the smallest thing that they think like, well, you know, that little like tile or something is off, like someone could trip on it, you know, like these things from that, like on up. We're really looking to build that culture to be able to feel safe to bring up any of these issues that we see. In fact, if you wanted to see it, it's been the plan for the HRO at MBAF has been published on the MBAF website for how we're building and sustaining that culture of safety, which can be used for other biocontainment laboratories in the future.
This facility will be a tremendous asset, not only to our nation's agricultural industry, but globally as well. A special thanks to Dr. Chad Meir and Dr. Robin Holland for joining this episode and highlighting the benefits of the NBAF facility. The research conducted here will be crucial for the swine industry, and we're excited to see what advancements will emerge. Thanks for tuning in to this month's episode. Be sure to come back next month for another timely episode on all things swine. Until then, I'm Delaney Howell, and this has been the PigX Podcast.
PigX is a national podcast hosted by the Pig Livability Project partners at Iowa State University, Kansas State University, and Purdue, and supported by the Iowa Pork Industry Center. For more information on the project, head to www.piglivability.org. Or to inquire directly with questions regarding the project, email ipic.iastate.edu. PigX, ideas in the swine industry worth sharing.